I fired him that day, even though I have no position of power over him, because he could have just said, "Thank you, Julius. Our contract is hereby terminated." And that would have ended the conversation. He's still my client to this day. 3 years by now. When they started with me, they were at like a 30 million valuation. They're like 850 million valuation right now. Incredible run that they've had.
Hey everyone, I'm here with Julius Bachmann, entrepreneur, coach, songwriter, and guitarist. Julius is a certified coach and has coached over 150 entrepreneurs backed by Atomico, A16Z, and Creandum, among others, has trained over 100 venture investors, and just recently released his first single on Spotify. During this episode, we discuss about the moment he decided to become a coach, the learnings along the coaching journey, and what are the most common challenges founders and investors have when they reach out to him. Enjoy.
For every session, it's a little bit different. I really have to make sure that I manage my internal state, my mental and emotional state. You know, you have to imagine every morning, 9 a.m., 9:30 a.m., I'm arriving at the office, having dropped off my daughter at the daycare center. And depending on the day and depending on the mood, things go well or things become a little bit more stressful. And I then drop into a coaching session with a client. Their client is depending on me to help them figure out their mental and emotional state. So I have to make sure that I'm contained and that I'm clean and that my stuff, whatever it is, doesn't spill over into their, you can call it field or whatever you want, but effectively, I need to make sure that I'm doing proper work. And so I try to really quiet down before I go into a session. I review the notes that I have from the previous sessions. Maybe there's a feedback conversation that we've had. Maybe there's something going on in the team. I just reread the emails. I make sure that there's all the news that I've caught up on regarding that company to arrive well prepared and with a clean slate, with a clean mind, so to say.
Can you give us an example of 2-3 problems that you would work with a CEO or with a team? Because I would assume that coaching is just so broad. And to your point, I also now like coach some CEOs and I was like, and one of them asked, how do you work with the other CEOs? And I'm like, so differently. Some of them, like some of them are interested in solving just different problems. So can you give us a sense of the problems that you work with them to solve?
Yeah. So first of all, I completely support what you said. It's very, very different, each individual to the next. And at the same time, I've passed the 150 client mark a while ago. There are recurring patterns. And there are three that I think I can call out that are the clear front runners in terms of themes. Number one is the question, am I still the right person for this job, the CEO job, and its next evolution? Do I want to be that person? Do I want to be the CEO, the next iteration of what it takes? And if I want to be, what change will it require in me personally, and then in my relationships, and then in my organization and business? Those are the three levels that I work on. So that's topic number one. It's the journey from founder to CEO with every individual step. Topic number two is, there is so much going on in my business, in my team, my personal and professional relationships. I am simply overwhelmed and I need someone to help sort out the mess and chart a clear path forward. And again, you see these three layers, the personal layer, the relationship layer, and the kind of organizational business layer. Those are the layers that I work with my clients on all the time. And if you work on a personal topic and it has impact and ripple effects into the business, that means you've created a ton of leverage, right? So I try to focus on these high leverage, high impact topics to drive a lot of value. And once we run out of things that generate a lot of value, we pause the relationship. But there's a third topic that I really want to mention, which is my relationship with the name, my co-founder, my key executive in marketing, hit a rough patch. Things are not going so well. And this can also be the relationship with my team, just the atmosphere. I don't know what's going on, but we're not vibing. We're not in flow. What do I do? I can't for the life of me figure out what happened. And this third request sometimes masks as we need help with communications, like how we communicate with each other, which is when I know, things are not going well in that team. Because typically there's an underlying conflict. There's a reason why they don't communicate with each other. They're holding back. And the reason they're holding back is they're fearing that if they really said what was on their mind, if they really spoke their truth, they would hurt the team, hurt each other. And so they're just not engaging in communications anymore. But so those are the three. Am I still the right person in the CEO seat? There is so much going on right now. I'm overwhelmed. And some sort of relationship is off and I need help and I need someone to help me kind of navigate the situation.
I have just so much respect now for coaches because, you know, if you don't deliver value, you're just out.
Right.
Do you remember the moment when you decided to be a coach?
There were many observations and insights that prodded me along on the journey to becoming a coach. Insights that just kind of manifested the confusion of why is there not some person who helps CEOs figure out the chaos that it is running a company, and mostly is a chaos, even if it looks all shiny to the outside. And later on, when I was working as an operator, I had the same confusion of like, what's going on in this team right now? What is my role? What is the other person's role? Why are they mad at me? What have I done? What's the dynamic here? What are our goals really? And still, at some point, I made this decision. The one moment that I can really remember was on a trip to Mexico on vacation. I was sitting on a super early morning flight from Oaxaca to Mexico City. And I can still remember the image in my mind. I was sitting at the window. I had this copy of the book, The $1 Trillion Coach by Bill Campbell. Yeah. I'm sure you've read it. It's a great book. I had it in my lap. I was reading and I was looking out over the Mexican mountains. The sun is coming up and I'm reading this book. And obviously the backdrop of that moment made for an inspiring kind of situation. But I thought, I'm going to commit to this for 10 years. I'm going to do this now. And looking back, so this was a couple of years ago already, I have never once regretted this decision. I'm still very much committing to another 10 years. there are projects that I start, businesses that I start. We just sold a business. I've started a business at the end of 2023. I'm recording this album that's coming out. There's the book that's coming out about which we can talk about later. There are all these things that I'm also doing, but the one thing that's stable, the one activity that is stable is coaching in the middle. And I can absolutely see myself in 10 years, in 15 years, in 25 years doing that. So I'm really, really happy I got into the situation. Mind you, I didn't even know what a coach was 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Wonderful story. And I mean, I can resonate so much with what you're saying. I had a call with Andy from Atomico. And I was like, yeah, actually, I'm also coaching some founders. And Andy from Atomico is like, oh, you should definitely talk with Julius. So it's very impressive to see also the goodwill that you've earned in the market with different VCs as well. I would imagine that a lot of VCs actually recommend you to their founders.
Yeah, that is the case. It's probably 50% of where my clients come from is, hey, we have a new portfolio company. They're looking for a coach. You're like, hey, you know, to my earlier point, co-founder relationship in this company has just not been going well, or the team has not been doing well. Can you just take a call with them? And oftentimes it's really that. Take a call with them and can you help them figure out what they need? Because most of the time, they don't need me. They need something else. In which case I'm like, cool, you know, here is an interesting coach who also runs a podcast and is also a former VC like you, or, you know, someone else, someone based in London, someone based in South Africa, someone based, you know, just in another neighborhood in Berlin, someone based in Munich. For after, you know, a couple of years in this industry and in this profession, I know what founders probably actually need. And at this point, I don't have the pressure that I need to sell my services to everyone that's out there. I'd rather keep everyone very, very happy based on my recommendation, which in turn then leads to all of the goodwill, because people can trust sending me people without me having any agenda.
And how did your coaching evolve? So you started a couple of years ago. You also took the coaching certification.
Right.
How did your coaching framework evolve over time?
It's a great question. I think it's constantly evolving. It's still evolving. Coaching to me, or whatever it is that you would call what I do, is practice. You know the term deliberate practice? You heard of that?
Yeah.
I think it comes from like maybe sports psychology or musicians rehearsing all the time. The point I'm trying to make is every session, I try to be very mindful of what I'm going into and looking back, debrief what I've done. I work with a supervisor. I reflect in writing every week to make sure that I'm catching the insights that are coming up. And they're coming up all the time. I just have to be open and notice them and then work with them. So one, it's a deliberate practice and it's constantly evolving. But also I'm dropping, this is going to sound a little esoteric and spiritual, but into a deeper awareness of what it is that I'm doing. It's not just coaching. It's that I'm being a facilitating presence, a clarifying presence, a challenging presence, and sometimes a healing presence in other people's lives. Those people happen to have and run companies. That's a result of my marketing funnel, of course, and the community that I move in. But what I do, what my role is when I work with other people, is any mix of those verbs: facilitation, clarification, challenging, healing. There are many things that you can call it. And yes, I've taken a certification with the International Coaching Federation. I've taken scores of other trainings on different niches of coaching. But ultimately, I think deliberate practice is much more important than any individual training course that you could take.
And what do you think about when you say healing?
So that's a wonderful question. My clients, when they come to me, they have a reason they come to me. And they have a reason they want to work with me. And not with anyone else, but with me. There is something hurting in them. And again, I don't want to sound esoteric, but there is a pain point.
Mm.
You know, that's maybe a little bit more of business terminology, right? There's a pain point, and that pain point in the context of their business is valuable, which is why they're spending money, but they're also investing their time. They're also investing their attention, and they're trusting me with their attention. And so they're coming into the session, they're hurting with something, and they want that pain to be healed. That hurt could be something that had already happened to them, and they want to, you know, come to terms with what happened and get closure. That's healing. They want to navigate away from a painful situation, maybe prevent a painful situation, often in relationship and team situations where that's coming up. That's healing. And I have to caution that I'm not a psychotherapist. I cannot heal trauma. And by now, I have a pretty well and sensitive antenna when people are actually structurally dysregulated, as in not showing up with the mental and emotional functioning that a normal person would have. Which, fun fact, the people that we work with are not normal people, right? You have to be some kind of batshit crazy to start a company, pump it up with millions of euros, and say, it's all going to be fine. You know, the meme with the dog, the fire in the background and says, it's fine, you know?
Yeah.
And for most of my clients, that is the reality. So they're not normal. They're special in that sense. They have a really high risk tolerance. They're really bold, but it's different than being clinically depressed. And that I can pick up by now and say, to refer you to a professional. And it already happened a number of times that I started to refer therapists in my coaching mandates. Mm. And I routinely link up the therapists that my clients work with when they already work with a therapist and they're okay with the two of us working together. And so then it's a little bit like a sports team, you know, where you have like the performance psychologist and you have like the trainer and you have the conditioning trainer and you have the head coach and it all works together. It's a really cool feeling. If you have a company that's going well and there's a number of coaches that sit together and they kind of plot the next move and what the next evolution of the team is, those are really fun mandates to work on.
No, this is so wonderful. And I think what you just said is just so taboo because the founders have to perform. The founders always have to be smiling. It's almost like being in front of the camera, right? Because you're in front of investors, you're in front of your employees, you know, but things not always go well, but you can't really show that. And I think, I mean, I've seen the statistics, like how many founders struggle with depression, bipolar disorder. Assuming that we want Europe to be more competitive in the global arena, that means we need to have more entrepreneurs. So somehow we just have to normalize building the company, raising millions of euros, and sometimes it's going to go well and sometimes it's not going to go well. And that's fine. But I think like now for first-time entrepreneur, the pressure is much, much higher than for, let's say, like a serial entrepreneur. They build a business, they exit it. They already have maybe like the financial cushion. But I think, I mean, like the work that you're doing is very important. And I think the nuance that you just mentioned there that I think is very important, like sometimes the founder, you just can't help them with what they need. You need to refer them to a specialist. So noticing that difference and not trying to solve it because probably that goes a little bit above your pay grade or you're just not specializing in it, you can actually do a little bit more harm.
Yeah. And it's the same with a marketing advisor. You know, I came just before we got on to talk. I had a session with one of my clients of mine and we happened to talk about strategy and pricing. Yes, I can talk with them about strategy and pricing. If for the next three sessions, that's all we talk about, I am going to refer them to a marketing advisor in my network. I do this all the time.
Wonderful. And also you've coached CEOs backed by Atomico, Creandum, A16Z, so top tier investors. Also you coach investors. What are top three mistakes you see founders doing again and again and top three mistakes investors doing again and again?
Great. All of these individuals are typically highly ambitious. And so the number one for both of them is that they're trying to use the same tool set that got them into the trouble that they're in, navigate them out. What do I mean? They've gotten themselves into a situation, rational thinking, trying to exert control, to try to be as smart and fast and hustle as possible. And then suddenly they realize that's not going to pan out. Then they try to outsmart themselves and out-hustle themselves. And that typically just makes them dig in deeper. And that goes for investors as much as it goes for entrepreneurs. Because typically, they're kind of made from a similar cloth. And so that's number one for both of them. And I have to say, investors are maybe 20% of my coaching practice. Just by the statistics, there are way more entrepreneurs than there are investors. Number two, and now I'm talking about founders, not focusing on their relationships enough. And I'm not even talking about their mental well-being. I'll get to that in a second. But not focusing on the relationship with their key people inside the company. What's the level of trust that I have to my head of sales? What's the level of alignment that I have with my head of sales? How does that track over the last couple of months? Did it go up or did it go down? What are the two, three things that I can do that may be low-hanging fruits to positively impact the level of trust, the level of alignment? You can, you know, name any measure of how you want to measure the quality of a relationship, but generally, that's something that entrepreneurs don't focus on enough. Two, three, again, mental well-being and the fact that their performance is based on their mental well-being And their mental well-being is based on their physical well-being. Mm-hmm. And if they don't eat right, if they don't sleep right, if they don't work out every day, not every day, but like regularly, it's not going to work. Like the machine isn't set up in a way that you just ignore the foundations and perform over the top for years. Coming to the investors, number one is already there, right? Trying to outsmart yourself. Now I have to think of all the investors that I worked with. One of the mistakes many of them make is that they try to justify using their intuition and not making sound arguments with pattern recognition. And that is just a sign for laziness. Pattern recognition is a great thing to say because people don't really understand what it is and you can't break it down. But it's a proxy of all the companies that you've seen in the past and therefore includes all of the bias that you carry. And I think that's a fundamental mistake in terms of working with portfolios, but also picking the companies that you want to work with, picking the companies that you don't want to work with anymore. Is the whole pattern recognition thing that they think they know based on intuition, and it's just a justification for not making a rational argument. It's totally cool to use intuition. We're tapping way more brain power and our nervous system by using our subconscious, but let's not do it to hide that we're super biased and we don't want to talk about it. So that's number two. And number three is, don't throw bad money after good money. I think for a very good investor, the very painful choice of where to disengage is really important. And I'm saying this supporting the entrepreneurs on the other end, right? Who say, I can't believe it. That person just vanished, right? But I'd rather have a VC who says, I am sorry. Our fund model is set up on a few companies, making it to at least 50x. Otherwise, it's not going to be worth our attention. You've been going for 5 years and you are just returning the money that we put in. We are going to deprioritize it now. In fact, some European funds, including one of the investors of my friend's company, have handed back the shares, said, not for us, thank you very much. Here you have your shares back. You can do whatever you want with it. You need a clean cap table. We know that. And we're going to be in your camp if you need anything, but we're not going to be on your cap table anymore.
No.
Just to say, be very mindful of where you spend your attention because it's so incredibly valuable as an investor. And that also means to divest your attention at some point if it's necessary.
Yep. And I think, like to your point, in the end, it's in the best interest also of the founder, you know, straight talk and direct talk in the end. Maybe it's just better for you to start a new business. And I think like founder friendliness should go up until one point, or like to your point, like it shouldn't just throw bad capital at it. And believe it or not, I just had a call today with an investor from a 1 billion euro fund telling me how, you know, they're founder friendly in the sense that, look, if it doesn't go well, here are your shares back at no cost, you know. And cool. I'm like, oh, wow, you know, that's a little bit unheard of. But now that you also mentioned it, and probably that is maybe a good solution to depart ways in a friendly way.
Yeah, maybe it's the same fund, though.
Yeah, maybe.
And there's just one.
Also, just coming back, maybe circling back on a board discussion and European boards and the dynamics. In a recent article in Sifted, you talk about the ego at the board level. Tell me about the work you do with boards and what are the problems that you see there? And how can we improve board governance and the relationship between CEOs and board members?
Right. So the work that I do with boards is typically because I am mandated by the CEO. So I work with the CEO and we then together tackle the board issue, whatever that is. And here and there, I facilitate boards and board meetings, but that's a small part of my work. I'm saying that because the way I can work with boards as a completely independent person is very different from the CEO, who then has to take an actual leadership role, right? And that That person, the CEO, my client, is typically part of the board, right? And the ego part of the, or the ego criticism that I have voiced in that article typically has to do with investors trying to show off to other investors they're in slight co-opetition with during the board meetings, how well they're doing and how valuable they can be. But that's a bit more self-serving in some situations than it is actually serving the company. And I am massively generalizing here. I know that. I'm trying to be a little bit of a provocateur to raise awareness and to make things better. So whoever feels triggered by this, please give me a call and let's have a chat. That's the ego problem. The other problem is that board meetings are typically treated as items in the calendar, not as a team that they're a part of. And that's partly because the interaction between the company and the shareholders, often one-on-one, outside of the board conversation, the meeting, it's a one-on-one and like, hey, you know, we can help you with marketing advice. Let's set up a separate session. So you don't know what else is being talked about. And when the board does meet, it's once a quarter, maybe half year. And it's one of 5, 7, 10, or 12 boards that investors sit on. So it gets very messy and very confusing. And at the same time, if we were, and I'm saying we now as members of the venture community, if we were more serious about the role that boards can play in building value in companies, we would try to form a team much like the executive teams that we're trying to form on an operating level, right? In the English language, we're talking about an operating director and an executive director and a non-executive director, right? And there's a team of non-executive directors. So I think if we only manage those two things, check your ego at the door and try to be as value generating for the company and ignore everyone around you and how that may shine on you. And then let's play as a team. We would already have made 80% of the way. I'm convinced that's the case. And again, when I work with my clients, I have to do that work indirectly because very rarely am I the person facilitating the board conversation. Most of the time, I don't even participate in the board conversation.
Got it. There is this quote from Carl Muntekat, like the founder of OODA. They just actually merged with Madhem. And this is, I think, a saying from a Japanese Six Sigma master, you know, in process improvement. Happy, but never satisfied, in the sense that you're happy when you see all the work that can be done to improve something that makes you happy, but you're never satisfied. So I think also this is one of the ways that you can improve by being able to take constructive criticism and leave, you know, your ego at the door, because then everyone is going to be better off, both the investor, right, the entrepreneur, and the whole ecosystem, when you can be transparent and you can always try to be better. Now, let's change gears a little bit and let's get personal. What is the moment of pleasure for you as a coach? Is it the first meeting? Is it when you see an aha moment in the founder? Is it after you've worked for a year and you see, wow, from A to B, such a transition? Probably I've also played a little bit part of in that.
It's the second. It's the moments of insight. The moments of insight when I see their mind, you know, the exploding head, when I see their mind going, wow, I just figured something out for myself. And mind you, I'm not saying I taught them something. That's not my role. I'm not there to teach them anything. But if I can be the facilitator for my clients to make considerable advances in their own insight, is it about themselves, the way their companies work, the way their operating model is set up, the way their team dynamics work, and how maybe they can influence that, that's when I'm alive. That's when I'm coming home and I say to my wife, do you know what happened in the session today? It's really great, you know, this and that. And these moments are priceless. Of course, it's great to have someone to you at an event or just like at the end of a session say, you know how much your value contributed or your work contributed to our transformation this year, of course it's great. Mm. But it's always like, you don't need to say that. Like, you pay me, that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, thank you very much. But I enjoy much more when I just see the individual steps you take. Mm. And it feels a little off to say I'm proud then, but I am, you know. Mm. I'm proud, I'm really happy for them.
And what does a good coach look like? So for founders listening or investors listening, and they want to choose a coach.
Yeah, good coach for entrepreneurs, and I'll count investors as entrepreneurs just as well, has seen many businesses from the inside and outside and has done some serious reflection on their work, on their why, on their approach, on their presence, as I talked about it before, right? The different modes that they want to work in. Training is secondary, but welcome. Good coaches don't need to be certified, but they should have very strong morals. And at last, they should come recommended or have some sort of reference. Astounding how few people ask for references when they talk to me. Maybe because they were already recommended to me, so that's a good sign. But when someone is at the very beginning of their journey of looking for a coach, I always ask them to two more coaches before they come back to me. It's such a nebulous market, and there are so many quacks who don't really know what they're doing, but have great marketing slogans. And it makes a lot of sense to talk to a couple of coaches just to get a feel of what's going to work for you. But again, some real life business experience and the respective reflection goes a long, long way.
Also, you're in a privileged position to be mostly fully booked during these days. Tell me about a time you fired an entrepreneur.
This is so funny because I actually thought about this morning. So there are different ways of firing an entrepreneur. There's the way of firing an entrepreneur to say, hey, you know, considering all that we're investing in this relationship, I don't think we're actually generating enough value. Let's take a break. There is also the case where I have said to my client, dear X, I think it is time for you to step back for a couple of months. Focus on your own mental well-being and that of your family. If you keep going like that, you're going to ruin both your company and your family and yourself. And you're going to look back on this year and are not going to be happy. It's a rare instance in which I'm going against the principles of coaching as it was drilled into me throughout my training and accreditation. But I do have a responsibility as a fellow human to my clients. And I know, I'm very aware that I have an outsized influence on the people that I work with. So in that case, because of the family situation my client was in, I said, take a couple of months, come back when you feel better. It's better for everyone. Now looking back, he says that was the best decision he took that year. It was a really tough year for him. He said it was the best decision for him to take. And yes, I guess I fired him that day, even though I have no position of power over him, because he could have just said, thank you, Julius. Our contract is hereby terminated. And that would have ended the conversation. He's still my client to this day, 3 years by now. When they started with me, they were at like a 30 million valuation. They're like 850 million valuation right now. Incredible run that they've had.
Absolutely. And I think this is exactly what you said. You win trust when you're just very honest with someone and you speak your mind. So they treat you as a peer, as someone that they would listen to. Because in most of the relationships, it's just so in a pyramid, no one will tell them that. And everyone probably quite the opposite, push, push, push. But because you were just so honest with what you think, he definitely trusted you more because of what you said. And because you risked, in a way, like losing him as a client, you didn't care about that.
Exactly. I risked that. I can risk that because I have many clients and I would rather speak my truth and be fired than to hold back and continue on and then have to face the question, why didn't I say so earlier? But to your point, in order for me to be able to speak my mind, I need to clean up my table before I get into a coaching session. Because otherwise, there are so many other things on my mind, so many tabs open in my consciousness while I'm in the coaching session, that I won't have the presence to say, this is where the road ends. You have to take some time out, right? You know, by now, I can keep a 90-minute coaching session going in half subconscious mode, and people wouldn't exactly notice. Then I'm just an average coach. To get from an average coach to a great coach, you have to drop into the presence of the moment, into your intuition, and be able to speak the truth, even if that means you're going against coaching principle. But if that's what's needed for that person in that situation, then you're the best coach or the best facilitating, clarifying presence, whatever you want to call it, they can have.
Wonderful. I love that. And the last question for the first-time founders listening, what should they do, one or two things that they can do very easily to not feel overwhelmed and normalize the ups and downs and continue to build their business?
Yeah. And for now, I'm going to sideline, get a coach. So that's not going to be the recommendation. Number one is start journaling. Journal at the end of the day or at the beginning of the day. Doesn't matter if it's structured or unstructured. Just kind of follow what's easy for you. The habit easy for you so you can keep it up. You don't even have to review what you've written, but to just get the stream of consciousness going, it's really valuable. I've been doing it for years. I've recently checked out my journals from like 2012. Number one, start journaling. Number two, join some sort of self-help group, other CEOs, other founders, and just as a place to share your experience and to make sure that people listen to you. They are typically way more affordable than hiring a coach. Of course, it's not as customized, but honestly, oftentimes that's, you know, 80% of what you need is to feel heard. Feeling heard comes much easier from people who are in a similar situation than you are. So that could be entrepreneurs organization, young presidents organization, the local accelerator, your venture capital founder community, anything goes. Join some sort of group that you can talk to.
Wonderful. I'm also actually building this peer support network. So,
here we go. Yeah.
So just join our peer support group.
Uncoordinated advertising. I wasn't aware. Great. Yeah. Do that.
Awesome. Awesome. Julius, thanks so much for taking the time and sharing your journey, your advice for founders. Thank you very much for the contribution that you do in the European ecosystem. I think we need more entrepreneurs. We need more coaches, good coaches, and we need to make Europe more competitive on the global arena. Thank you very much, Julius.
Thank you very much for having me. Great conversation.